Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Wealthy people do things different than, air quotes, average people, including the ways in which they teach their kids about money. At least that's according to author Steve Siebold. He argues that while average people teach their kids the basics like saving and budgeting, rich people teach their kids to be, well, you guessed it, rich. Siebold is the author of Secret Self-Made Millionaires Teach Their Kids. Some of the tips are compelling, some are completely contradictory, but all are good for thought. Then from landing your dream job to renting an apartment or even buying one, credit scores can affect major life events. But some Canadians still don't understand the role their credit score plays. Online lender Borrowell is launching a new credit monitoring service that's working to change that. And how to pick the right mortgage. There are a lot of variables to consider, and offers change all the time. We're going to talk to Robert McLister of RateSpy for his latest and greatest tips. Plus, increasing your net worth. There's a lot of numbers to keep track of when it comes to personal finance, but there's one number that gives you a pretty clear snapshot of your financial life. We'll learn what Canadians can and should be doing to grow their assets. Leslie Ann Scorgi will be our guest. She's with MeVest.ca. All that is ahead. Let's get started. It's important to start teaching your kids about money early on, outlining the basics like saving and budgeting. It's key. But what about teaching your kids to be rich? According to our next guest, average people teach their kids to survive financially at best. Rich people teach their kids to be wealthy. Steve Siebold is the author behind Secrets Self-Made Millionaires Teach Their Kids. He joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Hello there.
Hey, how you doing?
Who is this book for? I can imagine it really, really resonates for people who really want to be rich. And it's a little repellent for people who are focused on social justice or making a difference in the world. Who are you targeting?
Yeah, that's really it. Well, I'm targeting people that I get emails from all the time, and people, the audience members, when I give speeches and do media appearances and that type of thing, that say, look, you know, I've never had any money. I'm probably never going to have any money, but I don't want my kids to struggle like I did. You know, what advice would you give me? I've been hearing that for 20 years at least after interviewing so many wealthy people over the years and writing books about it and whatnot. And so that's what the book really is for, the average person who doesn't want their kids to struggle financially.
This book has 160 short chapters, and you recommend reading one of the chapters at a time and talking to kids about it. You do not have kids yourself. How did you market test this one to make sure that it would work?
Well, I've been interviewing wealthy people since 1984, Bruce. I started in 1984 as a broke college student that wanted to be rich, and I grew up with rich kids. I was not a rich kid myself, but I grew up around them on the national junior tennis circuit, and so I started interviewing self-made millionaires and billionaires, and I've interviewed over 1,200 of them around the world to date. And so that's what one of the questions I asked, because I always thought I would have kids, was, you know, what do you teach your kids about money that the middle class does not? And that's what the book is all those answers from 30 plus years.
We're going to go through some of those tips in a second, including some of the ones that some people, me included, might say are contradictory, some of the tips. But I'm going to start with some of the simple ones. First, you deserve to be rich. What does that mean in this context, and why is it an important lesson?
Well, in a capital way, because I think a lot of people think that there's something wrong with being rich, like they don't deserve it. In a capitalistic society, you know, if you serve people and you solve problems, well, then you deserve to be rich. That's what capitalism is, it's the foundation of capitalism. So that's the concept, to try to take away the idea that there's something wrong with wanting to be rich.
And yet, if you just look at that phrase and you raise your kids with that as a mantra, you run the risk of them growing up to be pretty entitled, which is problematic for old money families. But I can imagine it's incrementally more problematic for self-made folks who, you know, picked themselves up by the bootstraps and made every penny on their own. How do you reduce the risk that your kids are going to be entitled?
Well, if you read the chapter, it's all context. So, I mean, the context that the chapter title doesn't really explain the chapter. But what it really means is, again, they deserve it if they earn it. It's not saying they deserve it just because they're born and, you know, in a certain place or time or country or whatever. It's based on their ability to serve people and solve problems.
One of your tips is talk yourself up, followed two pages later by don't delude yourself. So how do you reconcile these two?
Well, don't delude yourself is about living in a magical, wishful thinking world, which you know, a fair amount of the world does live in that, and the first world does live in sort of the idea that, you know, somehow I'm going to have all this success someday, or I'm going to win the lottery, you know, or I'm going to somehow have this windfall and all this money's about to come to me. We've got a bunch of people in the United States right now, the baby boomers, and most of them have very little money to retire on, and they're going to live another 30 or 40 years, and they have almost no money. So there's sort of the delusional thinking. Talk yourself up is a different concept. That's the idea that the way you talk to yourself, the way you talk to yourself, especially around money, should be positive, should be uplifting, should be, you know, encouraging yourself to move forward without fear. So they're two different concepts completely.
Another pair that, and I appreciate the reconciliation of that, another pair that seem to contradict are learn to suffer and have fun. How do you do that?
Well, there's actually a lot of fun. It sounds as funny as it sounds. I think there is fun in suffering in terms of when you're working toward a goal, as you know, kids don't know this, but you know, most adults that have achieved something do. You know, when you're working toward a goal, it's actually that there's suffering involved because there's sacrifice involved and hard work involved and all the things that we adults all know about, but kids, you know, are not that familiar with. And you can have fun while you're, I mean, athletes. You know, I was a professional athlete 100 years ago, and I coached lots of professional athletes for many years. And, you know, they have a great time, but they're suffering physically and mentally a lot of the time. I mean, athletes, especially professional athletes, you torture them as a coach. You have to make them that good, but they actually enjoy it. It is kind of contradictory in some ways, but, you know, every athlete knows that's sort of the system. You enjoy the suffering process, in a sense, which is a little strange, but it works.
You and I can't remember this specific tip. I don't have it right in front of me, but it was around equal pay and the thought that you only deserve equal pay if you are doing equal work. Tell us about your thinking on that one.
Well, again, I think it goes back to the you know, the principles of capitalism, which not everyone agrees with, but no one that doesn't agree with it should read this book, really. I mean, if you're not a capitalist, don't waste your money on this book. Buy something else. But this is for people that really believe in a capitalistic, you know, free market society. So That's really what it's about. I mean, it's about if you're doing the job, you should get paid. If you're not, I don't care what color you are, what gender you are, you know, you should be getting paid. But if you're not doing the job, then you shouldn't get paid. It should be an earning situation instead of a more of a socialistic approach where, you know, like the minimum wage laws we're going through here in the United States are ridiculous. They're overpaying, and the companies are compensating by laying workers off because they're not worth the money they're supposed to be paying.
How do you weave in the gender dynamic here? Because we know from a data standpoint in all developed countries, there still exists a pretty significant pay gap from a gender perspective for lots of different reasons. How do you work that through that particular tip?
I don't really think this is as big a problem as it's made out to be. I mean, I think in the past, of course, it was, but at least in the States, you know, it's I mean, I've employed hundreds of people in my career, and you know, and it's the people I've had, you know, lots of women work for me, lots of men work for me, and as long as they can do the job, they get the pay. I mean, we don't discriminate. I don't think most companies are discriminating based on gender. They're discriminating based on what you can actually do. So if a woman is not capable, or a man is not capable, for that matter, of doing what the woman can do, I don't think gender has anything to do with it. It's really about production. It's about results.
Yeah, I guess where that's complicated is in a heterosexual couple where the female of the couple needs to be primary caregiver to the kids. It becomes very difficult for her to continue to progress in her career if she's the one who needs to take the maternity leave and pick up the kid by 3:30 or 4 o'clock or whatever else. There's a bunch of other factors that weigh her down.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's not a perfect system. There's no question about that. Yeah, that answer is beyond my pay grade, I'm afraid, Bruce. I don't know the answer to that one.
It's an interesting one. Never take your eyes off money, followed by wealth without fulfilling work equals a hollow, unsatisfying life. I know you're not loving that I'm pairing absolutely some of these tips and some of the content underneath them, but I think it helps to flesh out really what your message is.
No, I think it's a great, I like your comparisons. I don't think there's any contradictions, actually, but they sound like it by the chapter titles. But no, I think the idea of keeping your eye on money is you've got to, I think most people don't focus on money, at least in the richest countries in the world, most people don't have any money. The top 1% owns all the money. And I think a lot of it's because people are not taught to train themselves to focus on money. It's one of the most important things in life. And I think anyone that denies that has never either had money or doesn't really understand that 90% of life's problems can be solved by writing a check. And that's just reality. I'm not saying it's right or it should be like that. That's just the way it really is. And so why would you not focus on something that can solve 90% of your problems that if you don't focus on it, you're going to struggle with your whole life as a result? And most people do, unfortunately, and it's not necessary. So my recommendation is to teach kids to have parents teach their kids to focus on it. But to your point on in terms of the other chapter, money without fulfillment is hollow. It's important still, but it's hollow. So the idea is to teach kids to seek fulfillment while they're seeking money.
Play rich sports like tennis and golf, but you hate golf. Thankfully, you were really good at tennis. Hey, I hate golf too.
Yeah, the funniest part about this is I've had some of the best properties on golf courses and country clubs because we're real estate investors. And I hate golf. It's the craziest thing. People come over to my places and they're like, "Yeah, how can you not, you know, love golf?" I hate golf, but the idea with this chapter is to teach the kids to go toward, not to force them to play golf, tennis, and polo and the rich sports. But if they give them a shot at liking sports like that, because that's where the rich hang out. The ultimate sport, obviously, is in North America at least, is golf. In terms of the rich, I mean, tennis is probably a distant second. But certainly golf is, you give them a shot to play the sports of the rich. I mean, I belong to a club in Atlanta. It's a very nice club. And I go over there we were there on Sunday having brunch. And it's like, you see these kids coming. These are all rich kids. These are all rich kids with contacts all over the country. And they're 15 years old because they have the advantage of being in a rich sport at a rich club. And it's not a level playing field. I mean, they're going to come out of school with more contacts than most adults have when they're 50.
So other than playing sports or in addition to playing sports, how do you encourage people who don't have means, who don't have a way in for either gender or racial or income reasons to develop a network? Because you do talk about the leverage that you have and how you can, you know, pick up the phone in Washington, D.C. and get what you want done because you have those relationships. But one of the real hurdles for people is the systemic obstacles to them making those connections because of all the reasons that I mentioned.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. I mean, the idea that it's a level playing field is, you know, patently ridiculous. I mean, that's crazy. So I'm saying it's not a level playing field by any stretch. So stack your, you know, a lot of people have a problem with that. But I would say, you know, don't let your kids suffer because if you've got a belief, some beliefs against that, the system is the system. Rich people are going to rule the world. They always have. They always will. Not saying it's right, but it is the way it is. So prepare your kid. By giving, even if you don't have the means, you don't have to have the means. Train them to think like this, to get into different circles, to think like rich people think, and they'll start to make inroads into it. You don't have to start out with any contact. I certainly did, and most people don't. You know, but certainly it would be a great advantage to a kid to know to start thinking like this and to start networking in school and try to get their grades up so they go to private schools, so they can go to great universities. And have all the advantages of, you know, of institutions like that.
One last question here. The greatest leaders in our culture, the Buffetts, the Gates, even Jeff Bezos, have a strong philanthropic bent. Mark Zuckerberg, they really endeavor to put at least a portion of their wealth to good. That is not a huge theme. You do reference it a little bit, but it's not a huge theme. Doesn't it feel irresponsible to have kids be so single-minded on such a self-oriented goal instead of values that would make the world a better place?
Well, I see your point. The problem is that most people don't ever get to the point where they've taken care of themselves enough and their families enough to the point where they can be altruistic. I mean, if you're Warren Buffett, well, that's a different story than the other people you mentioned, obviously. The other part about, so I would say, you know, take care of yourself. There's a reason on the airplane they say, you know, if the mask happens, the oxygen mask happens to drop down during the flight, you know, use yours first before helping secure the person next to you. There's a reason that take care of yourself first, take care of your own financial problems first, and then go save the world if you want to. The other philosophy is just that we put in the book is just for, you know, parents to help their kids consider the idea that they don't have to, with their money, they've earned it honestly. They don't have to give it away. They don't have to be philanthropic. It's sure, certainly a nice thing to do if you can. I agree with you 100%. It's great, but it's not their duty to take care of other people. That's the idea we put forward. Then people can decide whether they believe we're our brother's keeper or we're not our brother's keeper. That's up to them. But yeah, that's the idea, to say take care of yourself first and then decide if you want what you want to do with your own money.
Very interesting perspective. I think we're going to get a lot of feedback on that, Steve, but I appreciate you taking the time to talk about your book.
Hey, thanks, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Steve Siebold is the author behind Secrets Self-Made Millionaires Teach Their Kids.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
What's on trend for 2018 when it comes to mortgages? There has been a lot going on. Rule changes, interest rate hikes, and some leveling out of prices in some markets across Canada. So what should we be watching for in the year ahead? Rob McMillister is a mortgage planner at IntelliMortgage and the founder of RateSpy.com. Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
Big trends. What are some of the things that you are watching for in the mortgage market in 2018?
Well, the biggest one is the one you've been reading about in the newspapers, the federal government stress test. So this is basically a way to weed out more mortgage borrowers by making them prove they can afford a much higher payment.
Do you have a personal view on that? It's happening. There's nothing to be done about it. Do you think it is a appropriate safeguard or is it too hard and heavy?
It's appropriate for some, inappropriate for others. So before the federal government stress test, there's always been a stress test. It's called debt ratios. So lenders would always assess your debt ratios and make sure they're within a certain tolerance level. And they wouldn't give you money. They wouldn't lend to you if you're outside of that range. What the government has done is made that hurdle to qualify for a mortgage higher. And so in certain cases, certain types of borrowers didn't need that extra level of protection, let's call it. And one simple example, someone who is refinancing because whatever, they had a life event, they racked up a bunch of debt, and now they got to get out of debt. So they got to get rid of that, you know, $50,000 of high interest debt. And the only way to do that effectively, if you're a homeowner, is to refinance. And now it's a lot harder for that borrower to refinance.
What do you think that's going to do to pricing over the course of the year? I know it's very difficult to tell, and it matters a lot about the even the price band of the sort of mortgages that people have. But what would you say that that may do?
So the stress test affects roughly 1 in 6 uninsured mortgage borrowers. So these are folks that have at least 20% equity. And so what it does is it makes it harder to qualify for the same size mortgage, other things equal. So if you take that marginal buyer and you pull back his buying power, then, you know, it's simple, you know, economics. They're going to be able to afford less of a home, and it's going to put other things equal, downward pressure on home prices overall.
And it, you would think that in some niches, it might actually raise prices because everyone will have to go for the house that's in the 750 grand range. Wouldn't you have an inflation in demand for a certain tranche?
So it's a great point. It's kind of a closed system. So if you keep people from buying, they have to live somewhere. So they, you know, they're either going to rent or they're going to look for a cheaper property that they can afford. So what we're seeing is a jump in demand for lower cost properties, like a condominium, for example. So if you can't afford that, you know, $800,000 or $900,000 house, maybe now you're looking at a $600,000 condo. And in the big cities where demand is the greatest, we're seeing a noticeable a surge in buyers going towards that cheaper property. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, where the government's trying to make things more affordable, in a sense, they're making things less affordable in certain segments of the market.
What are the competitive dynamics looking like across lenders? As a mortgage planner, you work with lots of different ones, I assume. So there's the big banks out there, and then there's the alternative lenders. What's the how vicious is the fight for market share going to be this coming year?
Well, it's getting more aggressive every month, so or every quarter. So people are gravitating more and more online. So they're, you know, it's easier than ever to find out what a good quote unquote mortgage rate is, because you can hop on Google, say, you know, what's the best 5-year fixed rate? And you get a whole bunch of sites that'll tell you where the 5-year fixed rate market is at any given time. 20 years ago, you didn't have that luxury. And so the more informed the consumer gets, the more they demand better pricing and the more competitive it is with lenders. So a couple quick points on the competitive dynamics. Since the government has put in rules that prevent insured mortgages or reduce the number of insured mortgages, a lot of lenders that rely on insured mortgage financing can't originate as many mortgages. Hmm. And they can't fund their mortgages as cheaply as the big banks anymore. And now you're seeing actual rates increase at those non-bank or non-deposit-taking borrowers. And what that's doing is it's actually raising the overall level of mortgage rates for conventional mortgages. Now, a little different on the insured side. Because these lenders have to make up their lost revenue, they're trying to make up the profit any way they can. And the easiest way to do that is to be really aggressive on the mortgages, insured mortgages, that are the easiest to fund. So if you have less than 20% equity, you're going to get, generally speaking, a significantly better rate than someone with 20% equity or more. It's kind of like unintuitive.
What? I want to ask you about fintech. Wealth management is a part of the financial services world that has done lots of stuff on robo-advisors. There's now robo-planners happening. What are the fintech ideas within the mortgage space that you're most excited about or most relevant, do you think?
So anything that helps a consumer find a better rate on their own, choose a better term on their own, and get rid of bias. So there's a lot of bias in the system. You know, if you walk into a bank, XYZ Bank, that banker is not going to tell you to go to another bank down the street because they have a much better rate or a much better mortgage. Online, you do the research yourself. You can figure out what the best deal is at any given time in a matter of minutes.
So they can find the rate, but are these services going to get to the point where human beings really are, no offense, but you don't have a job?
There is going to be significant attrition in the mortgage space because of technology. So, you know, way down the road, if you're looking at how things evolve, you're starting to see it in other countries like the UK, who's well ahead of Canada in terms of online mortgage origination. You're starting to see things like bots, where you can go to a website and you can answer some basic questions and it tells you what mortgage is most suited to you.
Does it go crawl through your financial records? Is it like got mint-like capabilities to scrape from your bank accounts?
So today, generally, it asks you a limited set of questions, and then based on those answers, it makes recommendations. In the future, you know, there's going to be lots of opportunity to put in more detailed information, or maybe if you're with a big bank, you'll be able to do that on the bank's website because the bank knows a lot about you. Mm. It's going to know your credit profile, you know, your assets, etc. So yes, long term, the days of prime mortgage brokers and typical bank mortgage specialists are, I don't want to say numbered, but there's going to be a lot fewer of them.
One last question. 2018, what do you think we will see on the fixed versus variable debate? Because I know there are market dynamics in outside of the individual concerns that people have about those two different paths. What are some of the bigger themes that will affect whether or not homeowners will choose one or the other?
So anytime you have the Bank of Canada increasing rates, you have a rate hike cycle, you have more people generally going into a fixed rate mortgage because they're concerned about, you know, the rates will keep going up. So we have that as a very big trend right now. And so the market's looking for, you know, maybe one or two more rate hikes this year. And, so that affects the optimal mortgage term. Maybe you want to look at a 3-year fixed instead of a variable.
If you're risk tolerant, does variable win over fixed these days? I know sometimes the spread is minute What's it like these days?
So it really depends on where you go for your mortgage and what rate you get, because that spread between a five-year fixed rate and a variable rate is a key factor in choosing which term to get. So right now, for example, if you are an insured borrower, so you have less than 20% down, you can find rates as low as 2.15% or even better. Now, compare that to the average five-year fix, which is about 3.39%, and that's a big gap.
Right.
And so the variable rate discount right now for insured mortgages is the biggest it's ever been.
Wow. Interesting. Robert, thank you for your time.
Anytime.
Rob McMillister is a mortgage planner at IntelliMortgage and the founder of RateSpy.com. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, a new free credit report monitoring service is now on the market. We're going to learn more about this Canadian first that might help you keep a closer eye on your credit. And later, some specific tips on how to pick the right mortgage for you. You will not find me on Instagram, but you can find me, and I hope you do, on Twitter at Bruce Selry or Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A credit score is one of the most important numbers you can have as an adult. It can affect your ability to rent an apartment or get a mortgage and the price you pay for that mortgage. In some cases, it might even affect your job prospects if an employer looks it up. Most Canadians still don't understand the full role credit scores play in their lives. Borrowell has been offering credit scores for free for a while. Now it's offering a credit monitoring service for free. Borrowell COO and co-founder Eva Wong joins us now. Hello there.
Hello.
What do Canadians get with this new, this free Equifax credit report monitoring? What's different from the score they got in the past?
Yeah, so the credit score is basically a number that gives you a sense. It's almost like the grade on a report card.
Yeah.
But there wasn't sort of any other backup that we were giving before. And now we have the full report. So it would show you any credit inquiries, any sort of all of your open credit accounts and things like that. So it's basically like all the commentary that your teacher might write on
right.
a report
card.
Right,
so I get an A in the course, but
that's
Bruce
right.
talks too much in class. And if he could really stop
no,
distracting
I'm sure
the others, it was
I'm
totally
sure
what
it
they
was
said.
Never what they said.
I got good marks, but I was a little disruptive.
Right, right. Yeah, so this gives the backup. And the number one question that we had from our members was, okay, it's great that my credit score is whatever it is, but why? And what goes behind it? So now we can give a bit more information.
Now, historically, someone could get that credit monitoring. They just would have paid a price for it. Is
That's
this the
right.
same as what they would have got if they paid for that service from Equifax a year ago?
Yeah, so it's the same credit report that you would otherwise get from Equifax. That's right.
One important thing, we know you're not a not-for-profit. You make
that's
money.
Right.
You're
yes,
in business to make
right.
money.
That's
How
right.
do you fund this program for people? What's the business model? How does it make sense? Because one of the things you received some criticism on around credit scores for free
mm-hmm.
was people are giving you information, but they're not clear on the transaction that is unfolding.
Yeah, we are trying to be very clear about it. We do pay for the credit report and the credit score from the credit bureau. And that to us is really an investment. It's like a marketing cost. And one of the ways that we make money is that we do have our own personal loan. And then we also recommend other products to the members who get their credit score and credit report for us from us for free.
Right. So you would yeah. get marketing messages from Borrowell because you now know more about your consumers and can target stuff to them.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the last thing we want to do is spam anybody with like a ton of email messages.
Yep.
People can unsubscribe from those email messages as well if they feel like they're not appropriate to them. But we also have a recommendations engine. We try to be really helpful. So we give tips on how to improve your score and then products that we think would be helpful to people.
With the monitoring, there may be some things that either are a surprise or that are completely inaccurate. What are some of the actions that people can take when they get that report? How frequently do they get it? Is it like
every month.
Every month. So
every
email
month.
Comes, there it is.
Yep.
And if there's some stuff that you don't agree with or that you need to take action on, what do you do?
Yeah. So it really depends on what information is not correct. If there's something to do with your personal information, like your name is misspelled or they've got the wrong birth date, then you can contact Equifax and have them fix that. If there's something to do with an account that you think was should be closed but it's still open, then you can contact the provider. So you can contact the credit card issuer or whoever, the bank, if you think there's something incorrect corrected with the information that they're reporting to the credit bureau.
Tell us more about where the data comes from, because it really is quite a black box for people.
Yes.
We know, I mean, anyone who's alive and alive in today's day and age knows we're being monitored at all times from all sorts of different places. But as it comes to assembling the credit report and the score that is a function of that, where's the data coming from?
Yeah. So if you apply for credit, let's say you apply for a credit card when you're at the store and you get that credit card, let's say it's from the Bay. The Bay will then report back that you applied for the card. They'll report to the credit bureau and they'll give that information to the credit bureau. Bruce, you applied for a credit card. It has a limit of a certain amount, and this is how you're using it and whether or not you're making on-time payments. So then all that information is compiled from all the different lenders and banks that are providing the information, and the credit bureau is the one that is then compiling the score and keeping a report of that information.
And that goes to regular monthly transactions too, or at least payment history. So
That's
if
right.
I don't pay... Never happens. But if I were to not pay,
yeah.
then that there would be a note sent to Equifax or to TransUnion or whatever.
That's right.
To keep that up to date.
That's right.
There's a difference between hard inquiries and soft inquiries
That's
on
right.
credit.
Yeah.
Do those inquiries show up as a part of the credit monitoring?
So hard inquiries do, but not soft ones. So a hard inquiry is when you actively apply for credit. A soft inquiry is just your bank may do an occasional check to make sure that things are still in good standing. If you check your own credit report or your own credit score, and that's the same as if you check that with Borrowell, that's a soft inquiry. It does not affect your credit score, and that kind of thing won't show up.
What would you say to calm people's concerns about privacy?
Yeah.
I always thought – it's not that I don't have sympathy for the concerns about privacy. Those concerns, though, to me, seem to indicate that people have no idea just how much the world knows about them already.
Right.
But anyway, that's right. a sidebar. What would you say to people who are like, I don't want to set up the credit monitoring because they're going to know so much about me?
Right. So that's definitely a concern that people have, and we try to alleviate that. We use bank level encryption, security and privacy of people's information is top notch. We never share any of people's information with any of our third party providers. That's something that's also something that is near and dear to our hearts is we'll share information about them with you as a member, but we'll never share your information with any other third party.
What do you try and do to provide value add to what is in that report? So,
yeah.
you know, in the old days when you would just literally get like kind of a list. Are you trying to infographic it up or are there emoticons?
Right.
What is
there are emoticons.
Are
people
there really?
Love, yeah, people
oh
love the
God.
Emojis. Yeah. So we do try to make it more accessible and, you know, more friendly in terms of just using everyday language instead of using, you know, like credit report data. We understand a lot of times financial services is scary for people. So we are trying to just make it, you know, really easy to understand for everybody. Today we provide, you know, a nice little chart that tracks your credit score over time and other things. And we're really excited to be rolling out additional information, charts and graphs. And again, like really easy color-coded things to show you green is good, yellow, you're okay, red is bad. So again, just to make it really straightforward and easy for people to understand.
Just coming back to the score itself, what should people know about the gradation of good, you know, red,
yeah.
orange, and green?
Yeah.
What matters? I mean, when I got right. my score, I was kind of annoyed that it wasn't perfect.
Right.
It was good. It was amazing. I mean, I walk the talk in what I do, but
yeah.
I wanted perfect.
Right. So with the Equifax credit scores, it's very hard to have a perfect score. I don't think you can actually get a perfect score. So we've seen like the whole
it's like
range.
Gymnastics.
I guess so.
Unless I'm Nadia Comaneci, then I could
gymnastics.
Get a perfect score.
But the score ranges from 300 to 900. We've never seen a 900 score with the credit scores that we give out. So don't feel bad, Bruce. Like,
God.
You probably have one of the top scores. And I think the other thing to really reassure people is that 85% of Canadians have a good credit score. So I think if people are worried, it's like, oh, I don't want to get it because I'm afraid it might be bad. Chances are you've got a good credit score, but you can always improve it. So I think, you know, we're giving people tips on what they can do. And sometimes they're pretty easy. And we get great customer feedback of people following our tips and checking and monitoring their score and it going up over time.
in our last 30 seconds, what is the number one tip that you would say is less common, like that people wouldn't necessarily know? So there's things that you can do. I mean, just make sure you pay your credit card in full every time. Like those kind of mom and apple pie ones. Is there one that you'd think, ooh, this is like a new, it's not a Burwell tip, but I'm bringing it to you. You're welcome.
Yeah, no, I think there's one of the major categories is credit utilization, and that's how much of your credit limit you're using. So if you have a $5,000 limit on your credit card and you're using like $4,500, that's a very high credit utilization, and that's considered bad. So the lower your credit utilization, the better your credit score will be.
Can you fix that by just going out and getting a massive limit increase on your line of credit?
Yeah, you actually can. So it is just a percentage. I wouldn't go and run up a whole bunch all in 1 month because that also can be concerning. But anytime you're offered a credit limit increase by someone, you should take it.
Really? That would run. I understand from a utilization standpoint, run counter to what I would say because I panic that people are going to
use it. Yeah. You need to have the self-discipline, but if you cannot spend it, then
it's good.
It. Yeah.
Eva, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eva Wong is a co-founder and COO of Burwell. Stay with us. Coming up later, increasing your net worth. We'll talk about what you should be doing to build your assets for the future. But next, we'll get some tips from mortgage planner Robert McLister on how to pick the right mortgage for you. If you have a question about money, I may have already answered it for you. I'm the money columnist for Money Sense, an online personal finance and lifestyle magazine. You can find out what I've written on moneysense.ca. Then search for me, go through and check out some of the stuff I've written in the past. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Choosing a mortgage is a really big decision. There are a lot of choices you need to make that can affect the amount you pay and the flexibility you have if your circumstances change. Robert McLister is a mortgage planner at IntelliMortgage and the founder of RateSpy.com. He joins us now. Hello.
Good to be here.
What are some things you should know about yourself and your risk tolerance and even your financial circumstances before you even start talking? So whether it's your first mortgage or you're up for renewal, what are some things you should know about thyself?
So a lot of people come to us and say, what is the best mortgage term? And there is no such thing. So that's like asking, what's the best flavor of ice cream?
Chocolate. I can't even believe you asked that question. The answer is chocolate.
No,
maybe salted caramel. Like, I'd be willing to put that as a close second.
See, I would have said brownie chunk. So it really
good.
Depends.
Just as long as you weren't like pralines and cream or strawberry or something like that. It's ridiculous. Point well taken. I love that you brought ice cream into our conversation.
So, you know, to answer that question, the typical next question we get is, where do you think rates are going? Right? Because people want to know whether they should lock in or not. The fundamental decision criteria is what type of borrower you are and what kind of risk sensitivity you have. Mm. So I've come up with this lovely little acronym called IDEAS to help you figure out which term you're best suited for.
Ooh, okay.
IDEAS. So the I in IDEA stands for income. Do you have a provable, stable income? The D in IDEA stands for debt. So do you have a reasonable debt ratio relative to your income? The E in IDEA stands for equity. So do you have at least 20% equity so that later down the road, if you need to refinance, you can. A stands for assets. So do you have assets to fall back on if times get tough or interest rates go up and your payment goes up? And lastly, the S in IDEAS stands for sensitivity to risk. So are you going to freak out every time you see open the newspaper and see the Bank of Canada is going to hike rates next month? So you look at all those fundamental factors, and that helps you determine whether you have the financial ability and the stomach for a variable rate mortgage.
I think you should change the S to stomach.
Stomach?
I think that – there you go. Please. You're welcome. Okay. That S is for stomach instead of sensitivity. I think that's
pay
brilliant.
Your royalties for that?
Yeah. You know you don't. It's free. You're welcome. So term is one thing. What about – so let's talk term. Let's talk amortization, those kinds of big picture things. How do you think that through?
So amortization, let's talk about that. So if you have a short amortization, say a 10-year remaining amortization versus a 30-year, you can take a little bit more risk because the impact of rising rates is less if you have a shorter amortization. Another thing that's key is your credit. So if you have bad credit and you're trying to dig yourself out of a credit hole, then you want to be in a shorter term because you don't want to pay the sky-high non-prime interest rates. You want to, you know, take 12 to 18 months to rehabilitate your credit, and then you can look at a prime lender at much better rates. And then the other thing is the spread. So the spread between a five-year fix, for example, and a variable or a short, you know, one-year or two-year fixed. That's a key number. So the wider that spread is, the better your odds, other things equal, in a variable or a shorter term.
One of the things I learned about mortgages the first time round was that you can fix your variable payment, which blew my mind because I always thought, oh, well, variable payment. And then I noticed my variable payment was going down as rates were going down. And I said, no, I don't want that. I can still pay that. And my mortgage person said, well, you can set that number. And why I think that's such an important point is a lot of people feel like, ooh, I can't do a variable because it's too uncertain. When in fact, on some products, maybe not all, they can set their payment. It just then what shifts is the amount that goes to principal versus interest.
That's right. So a couple of points there. So most floating rate mortgages have a floating payment. So it goes up and down with prime rate. But what you're talking about is technically called a variable rate mortgage. So the one with a floating payment, that's called an adjustable rate mortgage.
Right.
So if you get a variable rate mortgage, yes, you can lock in your payment so that if prime goes up or down, your payment stays the same. Now, the only time that would ever change is if, for example, rates went up so much that you're not even paying the interest. In that case, the lender would adjust your payment.
Features. There are a lot of features you can get. I assume there's a cost associated with them because they can give you flexibility and, you know, the lender doesn't have the certain income stream if you're taking a mortgage vacation. Tell us about some of the features out there, the ones that you would sell to a sibling and the ones that you would keep your family members away from. I'm sure you treat your clients the same as your family members, but you get my point, right?
So you want to make sure you have flexibility when you need it. And so for examples of that, if you're young, you're getting your first home, the odds are pretty good that you're going to be moving in the next 5 years. Or if you're, you know, you get a mortgage, the odds are, generally speaking, people are going to renegotiate their mortgage within a five-year span. So if knowing that, you want to make sure that you have flexibility built into your mortgage. And that flexibility can be a low penalty. So the big six banks are notorious for their high fixed rate mortgage penalties, the interest rate differential penalties. 15 to 20% of people actually pay those penalties.
Wow.
So, you know, we could be talking the difference between, you know, a bank and a non-bank lender. We could be talking thousands of dollars in additional penalties to break your mortgage early. So you got to keep that in mind. Portability. Let's say, you're one of these folks that do move within a five-year span. You want to make sure you can move your mortgage to that new property and not have to pay a penalty. And some lenders only give you like one day to move your mortgage. So your old property and your new property have to close in the same day. And that's very hard to line up. So, you know, odds are greater in that case, you're going to pay a penalty. And lastly, you want to make sure that you have a competitive lender if you ever need to refinance with that lender. So, if your lender allows what's called a blend and increase, you can add more money to your mortgage without paying a penalty in many cases. And if your lender is competitive on the rate, then you don't have to go elsewhere and it can save you, you know, switching fees.
How loyal should consumers be to their legacy financial institution? And I know you're a mortgage planner. You work with lots of different ones. If I was talking to a mortgage specialist from a bank, they would have, I think, a different answer than you would have. But how do you think that through? Because so often people just get the renewal, they call up, they renew, or they could go and have the conversation with the lending specialist at the institution, and then they just renew.
So you owe zero loyalty to a lender. You owe loyalty to your wallet. And so you want to do what's best for you. Now, that doesn't mean you have to move. Maybe if, you know, all things told, the switching costs never or whatever make it non-economical to switch lenders. At the end of the day, you want to compare the full market. And you want to find not only the best rate, but the best flexibility, because typically where you see the biggest differences in borrowing cost on a mortgage are after closing. So it's not, you know, you saving 10 basis points on your mortgage up front that saves you money. It's you having that flexibility where you don't have to pay a huge penalty after closing, or you can add more money very economically. That's going to save you the most over the long term.
Do you ever feel used by looky-loos who are calling up and like, hey, Rob, I need you to get me the best, best, best. And then they take it right back to their institution and say, look what Rob gave me. Can you match them?
I don't. A lot of brokers do, but I don't. And, you know, I put myself in the customer's shoes because I want the best deal. So if you're not going to give me the best deal, or, you know, if your rate is significantly higher based on the service and whatever else you're, the value you're providing me, then, again, I owe nothing to you as a consumer. I'm going to go to, you know, whoever's going to save my family the most amount of money. So typically I just tell them, you know, look online. And I give them a couple places where they can go online and find a really good deal. And regardless, no matter what kind of relationship you have with your banker or broker, you always got to keep them honest. So you got to get that second opinion. So go online, search, you know, best 3-year fixed mortgage or best variable mortgage rate, and see if the number they're giving you is reasonable.
What is the number one, or maybe number one and number two variables that lenders deem to be the most important in cutting clients the very best rate and package of features that they have? Because, you know, they'll say it's a lot about relationship. Sure, that may well be. But as you look at your financial photograph as a consumer, what are the one, two, or three numbers that really are going to drive this for you?
So you have to have good credit. That's just step number one. So you want to be, you know, at least average credit or above. So if you're 750 credit score or above, that's a great place to start. You obviously have to have stable, provable income. And that can be a problem sometimes for self-employed borrowers. You have to have...
Or those that are working in the mafia. Who are trying to hide everything. That's a problem.
Yes, yes. Those are your typical stated income borrower.
Yes, yes.
You know, you want to have reasonable credit or debt ratios, rather. So if your ratio of debt to income is significantly over 40%.
And that includes all debt, right? Like, does it include student loans?
It includes any monthly debt obligation.
So student loans, credit cards, line of credit.
Car payment,
stuff.
You name it.
Do you have to declare debt to family members in that equation?
If it's not reporting on your credit bureau, generally speaking, it's not used.
Okay.
Yeah. And the size of your mortgage. You know, if you come to me as a broker and you have a $100,000 mortgage, you might get a different rate than someone who comes to me with a $600,000 mortgage because there's more profit in it and I can afford to give you a better deal because, you know, the time to process that $100,000 mortgage or $600,000 mortgage is about the same.
Huh. So I should buy a more expensive house so I've got a $600,000 mortgage. Is that what you're saying?
To keep Rob in business,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, that's exactly. I will never do that. Robert, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
Robert McLister is with IntelliMortgage and RateSpy.com. Stay with us. Coming up next, building your assets. We'll learn what Canadians can and should be doing to multiply their net worth. If this isn't enough moolala for you, you can pick up one of my books. You can get them online. The second of the two is called The Moolala Guide to Rocking Your RRSP. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When it comes to personal finance, there are a lot of different numbers to keep tabs on. The numbers in our checking account, in our savings account, various retirement accounts, investment accounts, all of them are important. But there is one number specifically that can determine just how successful you are in building your assets for the future, your net worth. I love your net worth number. Joining us to talk about this is Leslie Ann Scorgi. She is the founder of MeVest, MeVest.ca, a money school for Canadians offering one-on-one money coaching and employer programs. Hello there.
Hello.
Why should people be concerned about your net worth or even know what it is? Because if you were to survey a room of 100 people, I don't know what percentage you would say. What, 10% would have ever done a net worth calculation?
I would say maybe 10 or 15%.
Yeah.
So net worth is important because it is the measure that you want to grow. It's your assets minus your liabilities. So let's break that down just for a second. Assets are, of course, things that you own.
Yes.
And liabilities are things that you owe money on.
Right.
And if we're reducing our debts and increasing what we own, we're growing that net worth number. That's the thing that's going to fund your future. So you should pay attention to it.
I've been doing a net worth calculation every year since 2001. Mm-hmm. And I print out the pieces of paper because I've changed computers so many times. And it's so fascinating to see how that number evolves over time, in particular for people who've owned real estate in
that's
the last.
Right.
How do you think about the real estate component of it? Because in some major markets, that's really skewed, the net worth thing. And people might feel wealthier than they should, given that they hit the real estate lottery.
We see it all the time where people are feeling rich because of their homes.
Right.
And yes, traditionally, real estate does have a place in your net worth statement. It is a large component of your asset category. But we want to put it in its rightful place. It is not something that will produce an income for your eventual retirement. So just treat your house as a house. It's right. A place that you live. You definitely want to pay down that mortgage, but it is not a cash machine. And that's where we see people in expensive markets like Toronto and Vancouver really running into trouble. They're taking the equity out of their homes, and they're chalking that up to wealth. Mm. And that's not real wealth. Real wealth is assets like investments that generate an income for you for the future.
You have some rules of thumb. Now,
yes,
there's a lot of debate about rules of thumb. I happen to like them,
yes,
even though you can take any rule of thumb and break it down and find 12,000 reasons why it doesn't apply. But I like them because they're a starting point.
Right.
So you have a rule of thumb on Canadian households and a rule of thumb around assets people will need for retirement based on a certain income. You're saying $2 million by age 65.
Average Canadian household is going to need about $2 million to have an enjoyable retirement. Now, we are not talking about wild treks to foreign countries for many, many months every year. This is an average lifestyle. So $2 million is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Especially if you've been relying on your house as your core asset. What we want to do is diversify that and include assets that are going to total $2 million by the time you hit the age of 65.
Right. So you have a glide path here. You work backwards. At mm-hmm. the age of 30, here are the numbers that I have. You tell me if this is what you said. Age 30, $70,000. Age 40, $300,000. Age 50, $700,000. These seem massive. For some people, they'll be like, they've swerved off the road because they're listening to SiriusXM in their car.
One, there's actually a few things.
Don't do that.
You.
Everybody,
focus.
10 and 2
no
on the steering
distracted
wheel.
Driving. What you want to do here is break these numbers down, because for many, you're thinking, oh my gosh, I don't have 70,000 at 30 or 300 at 40, but you might actually be a lot closer than you think. So most people have access to employer pension plans if they are working in a traditional employer setting. So that is one of your sources of those assets.
Right.
The second is we have these wonderful tools called RRSPs and tax-free savings accounts. If you have been diligent in saving through automation, you might have a little nest egg there. And then the third component, if you have an interest in real estate, you may have gone out and bought some kind of income-producing property, and that is also considered an asset.
Are these numbers an individual or a couple?
I like to think of them as a household. Now, everybody's future is designed by them. So $2 million might be way more than what a couple would need in retirement, because they live a more simplistic life. And perhaps they actually live in a place in Canada that does not require so much of their money to go out the door every month in housing costs. Mm.
And they make their own shoes.
Yeah. So we have those scenarios, and they might be looking at that number saying, no, I actually need probably close to $500,000. Then you have the scenario where there's households that are big spenders. They have cottage, house, two cars, travel on their mind, putting their children through school, and maybe they're helping their kids buy houses.
Right.
Now we're talking about a net worth number by the time they're ready to retire, much greater, two or three times what we just talked about.
Wow. One of the things that young people have on their side is time. So if we were to think about that, you know, $700,000 number, which is where you say someone would want to be at age 50, a good portion of the glide path from 700 to 2 million, and really the glide path over the course of time, is going to be interest.
That's right. So we have that good old fashioned rule of 72, which basically means that your money should double every 7 years, 7.2 years. So from the age of 50 to the age of 65, when you retire, there should be two doubling periods. What I want to focus on, though, is the power of compounded interest and reinvested returns starts early. So the more you invest early, the more you give it time to build up on your behalf. It is a wonderful tool. We want to take advantage of it. And really, you also need to be very well invested. So you need to be on top of your investment advisor, watching your rate of return and ensuring every single month that goes by that your investments are a reflection of your correct risk profile and that you have a good investment advisor looking out for you as well as yourself.
So the call to action here for all of our listeners out there is to do a net worth statement. So
that's
what you own minus what you owe, and then you're going to have that actual net worth number. Any pitfalls in terms of that basic math? I mean, for a lot of people, as long as you're going through the checklist, it doesn't seem like that hard a thing to do.
Really, I would open up a Google sheet and make this super simple. List everything that you own and you owe. It's so simple. And then if you need help with that math, it's okay. We actually have some tools on our website, mevest.ca. You're welcome to download those net worth calculation spreadsheets or call a friend.
Right.
Call a friend. This is a very simple equation that you can do on your phone. You can do it right in the Google Sheet. Don't make this more complicated than it needs to be. The second part is that you need to see that number grow. If the number is not growing every single month, and then every year, you're doing something wrong. So let's have a look at that. And that is a very different set of actions that you want to take. Remember, you have two levers. You can only pull the debt lever, so pull it down, or grow your assets. When you combine them, that's when we get a lot of net worth growth.
And, you know, just before we go here, the real estate market can mask some kind of poor financial behavior, because
absolutely,
if you've seen this $300,000 in an increase in your house, mm-hmm, who cares that you've increased your credit card debt by 20 grand? Because it's all a wash. Whereas you and I would be like, wah!
Right. We see that and it's very frightening. Just remember, your house is not an ATM machine. That is bad financial planning.
Don't do that. Leslie Ann, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Leslie Ann Scorgi is the founder of MeVest, MeVest.ca, a money school for Canadians offering one-on-one counseling and a whole bunch of online resources, as she said. That is our program for today. What did you think of it? I thought it was pretty good. Did you think it was pretty good? Send us your thoughts, your questions, your feelings, all that to ask@moolala.ca. You can keep up with me and all things Moolala on Facebook, Bruce Celery Moolala, or check out Twitter, @BruceCelery is my handle there. You can download full episodes of this show on iTunes, or you can go to our website, moolala.ca, and listen to individual segments if that's easier for you. While you're there, feel free to write a review if you're on iTunes, or subscribe so the next episode will arrive right onto your device. Thank you very much for joining us, and have a great day.